Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our series on health and the rising rates of chronic disease in this country with Murray Carpenter, author of the new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Coca-Cola is the most popular drink on the planet. And when I read this in Murray's book, I had to stop and look it up online, and the numbers are right. Coca-Cola sells more than 2 billion servings of drinks in 200 countries every day. More than 2 billion servings of drinks in 200 countries every day. Coca-Cola also owns Sprite and Fanta. In his book, Murray Carpenter writes, "This book is the story of a decade in the soda wars, but it's not a simple one. The health risks of sodas are inherently complex, as are the shadow networks Coke has built to mislead its consumers. The health risks of sugar-sweetened beverages are not as straightforward as those posed by tobacco or even opioid abuse. Sugar-sweetened beverages attack the body incrementally, though widely varied metabolic mechanisms. It's not a blitzkrieg, but a death by a thousand cuts, a long, grinding ground war with odds heavily stacked against the soda drinker. For this reason, it's important to understand not only that sodas pose greater health risks than other items in the modern diet, but also precisely how they inflict the damage on the human body. That is at times complicated. More complicated still are the strategies Coke has used to confuse consumers about the dangers of sodas in order to maximize profits. Like the tobacco companies, Coke has developed a grand overarching scheme. To simplify the scheme is to serve Coke's purposes, to make it appear less cynical and sinister. Again, this complexity will challenge the reader, but only in the details will the full picture emerge." Murray Carpenter has worked as a print and radio journalist in Maine for 25 years and has reported for the New York Times, NPR, and the Washington Post. He's the author of Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps. His latest book is Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Hi, Murray. Thanks so much for joining us and congratulations on your new book.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. And congratulations on this series, which is so informative. I went back and listened to several shows.
Oh, well, thank you. We're actually getting an overwhelmingly positive response. And I think it's because the crisis is getting worse and everybody's dealing with something, whether themselves or their loved ones. And these issues just don't get the attention they deserve in the mass media.
Well, yes, I'm glad you chose that section to read from the book, because I think as as your shows are showing, there's so many facets to this chronic disease crisis that it's really hard to just say, well, let's do one show on diet and chronic disease. There's an awful lot to it, and it's not well understood. And one of the key points in my book is that many Americans still have not gotten the memo about the links between diet and chronic disease.
Right. And that's why we've been doing so many of these shows. And just to remind people what we're facing here, in your epilogue, you write, one study found that the obesity epidemic accounted for more than $170 billion in excess medical costs annually in the U.S. More than 35 million Americans, that's nearly 1 in 10, had developed type 2 diabetes. Life expectancy is falling. In large part, this is due to diseases like heart disease, liver disease, and type 2 diabetes. And the gap was widening between wealthy and low-income Americans, with the latter having lower life expectancy. And you can throw so many other diseases into that mix, including cancer, unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately, as your experience with your father shows, I mean, it's one of the, yeah, cancers are one of the things that is associated with soda consumption, particularly breast and colon cancers. But yeah, it's a complicated issue, and this diet link is so strong. And so, the point that I'm really trying to make with this book is that I think people obviously have known for generations that sodas are not a healthy, a health food per se. But I think still very many people, and I think the high level of consumption that we have in this country, very many people do not understand the very specific links to the increased risk for type 2 diabetes, for certain types of cancer, for overweight and obesity, that even what we would consider a modest amount of soda consumption, you know, say 12 ounces daily, can lead to. And so it, yeah, it's a vast problem. And, you know, you talked to Michael Moss, and that was a really, really interesting conversation. And, you know, his points about salt, sugar, and fat and ultra processed foods are fascinating. And I just decided to focus on this one very specific angle, the sugar sweetened beverages, and specifically the leading producer of sugar sweetened beverages.
I have to say, Murray, it is still shocking to read that more than 2 billion servings of Coca-Cola drinks are served in 200 countries every single day. I had to read that multiple times and then look it up. 2 billion a day?
Yes. And so let's be clear about that, because so the Coke does boast about that. I mean, that's their claim.
Right.
They also have products that are not sugar sweetened beverages. So that includes, you know, some of their waters, bottled waters, you know, juices, et cetera, et cetera. But regardless, they're everywhere. I think anyone who has traveled a lot has seen Coca-Cola signs, you know, in small towns all over the world, you know, in the middle of big cities. It's just, as they say, their strategy is ubiquity. They want to be within an arm's reach of desire. And Coca-Cola has done that not just in America, but all over the world.
You write, from Beijing to Bogota and along all the tiny little back roads in the hinterlands of the developing countries of the world, Coca-Cola truly is everywhere. It sells its products in more than 200 countries, and international sales account for 2/3 of its annual revenues of $46 billion.
Yeah, it's remarkable, and they have certainly exported the model that they honed here in the United States, their exquisite marketing, and their, you know, as I mentioned, their ubiquity, their idea of being within an arm's reach of desire, and they've taken it globally. And one of the things that has happened in the past, you know, 15 years is that soda consumption has first declined a little bit and then leveled off here in the U.S. And so they're pushing also, you know, greater growth, pushing for more growth elsewhere to kind of compensate for that.
Why did you decide to solely focus on Coca-Cola rather than the entire soda industry?
I've gotten that question several times. And it was that when I started looking at Coca-Cola, this book basically evolved out of my earlier book on caffeine. And when I realized that the caffeinated beverage that we're consuming most by volume is actually sodas, I really became sort of intrigued by the soda industry. And as I looked at the soda industry and became interested in these, you know, ever-growing science about the health risks of sodas, I started to look at the disinformation campaigns. And I realized that Coca-Cola was, you know, not only far and away the world leader in sugar sweetened beverage sales, but they're also very much head and shoulders above the other, you know, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, and others in terms of their very sophisticated disinformation campaigns. And, you know, they have cooperated, of course, with Pepsi and Diet Pepper through the American Beverage Association on some of these campaigns. But really, a lot of the work that Coca-Cola has done was sort of Coke-specific, and they've been a real leader on this.
Before we dive in and talk about all of the incredible research and data that you exposed, I want to ask you also about diet drinks, because a lot of people drink Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi. And I've always wondered this, because sadly, my dad was addicted to Diet Pepsi. At one point, he was drinking 10 to 15 a day. And bless his heart, he stopped. Although I have to say, in the last 5 weeks of his life, he asked for a Pepsi, but not a diet one. I'll never forget that. What is the difference between, say, a Diet Coke and a regular Coke?
Okay, well, first, I mean, let's talk about the similarities, because it's really important for me to understand, like, how these drinks got so popular. So for all of these sodas, the things they have in common is they're sweet, they're cold, they're carbonated, and they're caffeinated. And those are sort of the ingredients of the sodas. The diet sodas, a lot of people like them because they're concerned about the health risks of sugars. So there is a lot of evidence suggesting that diet sodas are not healthful for the long term. And some, there's indications that they might contribute to osteoporosis. There are concerns about your perception of sweetness. And this is a big one, like if you're used to consuming a very sweet product, whether it's a sugar sweetened soda or a diet soda, that may affect your appetite for other sweet things. There are concerns about diet sodas' impacts on your gut biome, and there's consistently concerns about whether or not they are carcinogenic. So that's a long-winded way of saying there are health risks there. The short answer I would say is that a lot of people use these consume diet sodas because they're concerned about the sugar in sugar sweetened beverages. And I would cite one of my sources, Frank Hu of the Harvard School of Public Health, who says he feels they're an effective beverage to use as a transition off of sugar sweetened beverages, but not necessarily for the long term. So, you know, we could talk about alternatives to diet sodas, but, I would say if someone's really has a problem, feels that they would like to reduce their consumption of sugar sweetened beverages, that diet sodas can be a bridge to a healthier beverage, but I would not suggest them as a long-term health strategy.
And you know how addictive these drinks are. You interviewed people who drank so many Cokes, and they couldn't stop.
This is something, and I know that this has come up in some of your other shows. This is something that's really interesting that's changing, I think. The conversation is changing in America. It's now okay to talk about food addiction, where really just a few years ago it wasn't. I was talking to an addiction researcher just yesterday who reiterated the same thing. She said, you know, that the conversation is changing. But yes, If you're addicted to Coca-Cola or addicted to a sugar sweetened beverage, you know, the cues are everywhere. One person I talked to said, you know, even hearing, a can pop open was enough to just sort of trigger that craving. So, yeah, they really are addictive. And one of the other things about addiction that one of my sources mentioned to me, which I thought was really powerful, was something that's worse than having an addiction is having an addiction that's not widely recognized to be an addiction. So that was really interesting to me.
It was also interesting to read in chapter 5 that the addiction is driven in large part by the drug caffeine. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper blend pure powdered caffeine into all of the top-selling soft drinks in the United States. There is some variation. Coca-Cola uses 35% more of the drug in Diet Coke than in Classic Coke, but all of the top sellers include caffeine.
Yes, and I think a lot of people, we very much understand caffeine as driving our daily coffee or tea habits. I mean, people almost use the term caffeine interchangeably for coffee. Because it's a smaller amount in sodas, I think a lot of people don't recognize the degree to which it's driving their cravings. And for this reason, you know, I often suggest if someone's asking about a beverage to substitute for a sugar-sweetened beverage, an unsweetened tea, which will have about the same amount of caffeine as a soda, 35 to 45 milligrams, is a healthy substitute. But yeah, caffeine is very much it's a critical component of these drinks, and the soda companies know why they're doing this. They're doing this because it reinforces the habit. If you reach for a caffeinated beverage and you like it, you're more apt to reach for one with caffeine the next time.
Reading about what these beverages do to the body was pretty difficult when I thought about just how many Diet Pepsis my dad drank. You write that sugar-sweetened beverages attack the body incrementally through widely varied metabolic mechanisms. It's not a blitzkrieg, but a death by a thousand cuts, a long, grinding ground war with odds heavily stacked against the soda drinker. Tell us more about that. What did you learn about what happens when you drink a Coke, for example, or any one of these sugar-sweetened beverages?
Well, the first thing that the body is doing is it's trying to metabolize all of that sugar. And so it's first of all, breaking down the you know, high fructose corn syrup or the sucrose into its components being, you know, fructose and glucose. The fructose is really doing a lot of work. When you have excess fructose and you're consuming a lot of it, it puts a lot of strain on the liver. So you're getting a lot of fatty deposits in your liver from the fructose. The glucose is you know, on mostly a separate path. It's rising, it's raising, you know, your blood sugar levels. And meanwhile, you're having to crank out more insulin to compensate for that that rising glucose. Some of that glucose is going to be deposited as glycogen in, you know, in fat cells or in muscle cells for later use. But it's a big pulse of sugar that your body has to deal with. And this is one of the ways that eventually it can lead to type 2 diabetes if you're on a very high sugar diet, is because you're just not able to produce over time enough insulin to compensate for that big dose of sugar. So it's hitting us in a lot of ways. And I think on an earlier show you mentioned, do you have a cousin who is who has kidney problems and is in dialysis?
Yeah. Sadly, yes. He has to go to dialysis 3 times a week. It's dominated his life. That's his life now.
And I think this is part of the chronic disease conversation that we don't have often enough is and I bring this up because we're talking about this blitzkrieg, is once all of these incremental things happen, then, you know, you may be working to prevent overweight and obesity. You may be pre-diabetic, and you may even be developing high blood pressure. And then somewhere along the way, you're going to have medical intervention. You may be on medications. As you're gaining weight, it may get less. It may get more difficult to exercise. So it's basically there's this vicious circle that ends up defining the latter periods of many people's lives. That is, you know, again, it's hard to blame it on any one medical condition, but the sum is a very unpleasant and often very expensive, you know, experience.
Yeah, that it's so sad because you basically just described what my dad went through over decades, and I'm sure so many of our listeners can relate to this. We have an email from a listener who writes, "My dad immigrated here in the 1960s and life was tough. Initially, fast food and soda was a form of assimilation, probably, but quickly it became something joyful for him. He loved Coca-Cola and had type 2 diabetes. He died of cancer. I think for a lot of communities, fast food and soda symbolizes happiness."
It's true. Yeah. And Coca-Cola has, of course, capitalized on this with their logos like, you know, open happiness. And yeah, even if you go back to that wonderful ad that they did, I mean, wonderful in terms of effectiveness, the I'd like to buy the world a Coke ad that everybody still remembers. They're just consistently associated with good feeling. So this is to say, you know, the listener's father's experience of associating sodas with good feelings and joy. I mean, some of that is inherent, but a lot of it has really been amplified through this really powerful marketing on Coke's behalf.
Today, we are speaking with journalist Murray Carpenter about his new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. He exposes Coke's campaign to hide very serious health risks, which disproportionately affect Black, Brown, and low-income communities. If you have a question or a comment for Murray about Coca-Cola and other sweetened beverages, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. If you have any stories to share about addictions to these beverages, or if you drink them casually and you just like to know what's in them, what is it doing to your health? You can also email your call at kalw.org. There's more misinformation than ever out there about health now, Murray. I mean, you've been at this for a long time. And just in the last couple of years, there are so many health shows on YouTube, and it's really hard to know what to believe. So I'm so appreciative that you have exposed so many so-called health professionals and universities that have been paid by Coca-Cola, but there is very clear science out there about what these beverages are doing to your body. So what would you say stands out for you the most, given that you cited so many studies in your book?
I would just say, go back to what I mentioned earlier, that even a 12-ounce can of soda, of sugar-sweetened beverage a day, can increase your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 25%. I mean, that's really dramatic. I'd say that really stands out to me. And, you know, to your point about misinformation, I think it's we're in kind of a perilous moment here because it is very, there are so many very persuasive people, you know, particularly on social media, who have ideas that would have been considered, you know, dismissed out of hand just a few years ago as completely bonkers, but who convey them very effectively. So it is very, I think it may be increasingly difficult for consumers to get the good information that they want. And I'm not sure, you know, how that ends up in our sort of, you know, divided media environment.
Right. And it's hard for people because they don't know if this health professional is getting kickbacks from a corporation like Coca-Cola, for example.
It's true. And this is, I think, a fine line here that was difficult to, you know, to maintain in the book. And I think that we all have to sort of maintain just every day, which is we need to be skeptical, of course. We need to be skeptical and recognize that some science is corrupted. But you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think, you know, in terms of some of the misinformation that you're seeing these days, vis-a-vis vaccines and other things, I think there are people who are basically saying all science is corrupt.
Right.
And so it really is a challenging moment, I would say, in terms of that. So, yeah, I think we all need to be skeptical. We all need to be critical thinkers. And but it's careful to be careful to sort of maintain a balance there as well.
It was also so fascinating to learn in your book, Sweet and Deadly, that the tobacco industry used Coke's playbook. I mean, we have done so many shows about how the climate denying world used the tobacco industry's playbook, but I've never before read that tobacco actually used the sugar industry, Coke's playbook. Can you talk more about that? How did you learn about that?
Well, I learned about that actually from a source right there at UCSF, Kristen Kearns, who's a dentist who became a really ardent soda researcher. And what she found was that when the Tobacco Industry Research Committee was forming in the 1950s, it hired its first science director from a group, the Sugar Research Foundation. And in his application to the tobacco group, he described the exact strategies that we now think of as the tobacco playbook. And this is, you know, generating science to counter existing science. This is sophisticated use of front groups. It's doing public relations campaigns to deny the science and basically flooding the zone with information, you know, to your credit and trying to drown out your opponents. So, yeah, that was a remarkable finding. And, you know, while we're talking about the UCSF team there, I really want to note the industry documents library that they have put together there, which developed from some of their tobacco work, was invaluable in doing this research. It's an archive that has hundreds of thousands of documents about the tobacco industry, the food industry, and it's very well archived. And, you know, particularly in this moment where we're noting that, you know, some federally archived documents are not secure any longer, it's really important that some places like UCSF are doing this kind of archival work.
In addition to that, and we'll go more into detail, you also exposed just how much Coke and Pepsi, how much influence they have on health policy. You write in your book that the results of a paper for the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that came out in 2016 was striking. Coca-Cola and Pepsi had sponsored at least 96 health organizations between 2011 and 2015. Concurrently, the soda companies had lobbied against 28 bills or regulatory proposals. This included legislation to restrict items that could be purchased with SNAP, implement soda taxes, restrict advertising, and improve soda labeling. So anytime a bill comes up, they're there with their lobbyists.
They're there with their lobbyists, and they're super, super effective, and they're very well connected. And, you know, as I mentioned in the book, they have an advantage over, say, Philip Morris or Purdue Pharma or Exxon, in that they still have a very, they're still thought of very positively. So it's not like a lawmaker has to say, oh, here comes Coke. These guys are, you know, the black hats, as you might think with Philip Morris. So, yes, they've been very effective. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things, there's a couple of interesting things we could talk about. They're very much in the news right now. One is that the, despite the soda industry's effort to preempt new soda taxes in California, Santa Cruz voters approved one. And today happens to be the day that tax goes into effect. So that is a win for public health. And that's kind of interesting. And the other we could talk about, if you want to, is Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s support of restricting the use of SNAP funds for soda. So there's a lot there. And yes, but all of these things have come up before. Every time there's a soda tax, every time there's a labeling initiative, like the one that was proposed for San Francisco, the soda industry is there to very effectively and quickly fight back.
And again, there's so much great information in your book. Again, we're speaking with Murray Carpenter, author of the new book, Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Since you talked about what's happening in Santa Cruz, you write that California Governor Jerry Brown stood by the elegant staircase in the governor's mansion, its hardwood floors shining, paintings and gilt frames on the walls. It was June 6th, 2018, a year and a half after a handful of cities approved soda taxes. Governor Jerry Brown was surrounded by 10 dinner guests, the men in business suits, the women in neat dresses. The guests were unrestrained, ear-to-ear grins, but Brown and his wife, Ann Gust, wore the sort of forced half-smiles associated with hostage videos. The guests had every reason to smile. They were executives from Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and the American Beverage Association, and they had convinced Governor Jerry Brown to support legislation preventing any municipality in California from enacting a new soda tax until 2030. This was a major victory for Coca-Cola and a huge setback for California's public health community. How did Coca-Cola do this?
Well, and I'm glad you brought up this specific campaign, because it's a great example to me of the idea that Coca-Cola is always sort of thinking three moves ahead on the chessboard. They really are consistently playing a long game. And it, you know, public health advocates are always sort of trying to play catch up. But what they did was they gathered enough signatures to put an initiative on the ballot in California that would have prevented, that would have required any municipality to get 2/3 approval of the city's voters in order to raise any tax. And so it's the kind of thing that a municipality would hate. And it was designed not for that reason. It was not, taxes were not the end goal. The goal of this campaign was for Coca-Cola and Pepsi and the American Beverage Association to develop something that was so abhorrent to legislators that they could go to Sacramento basically with a chip to trade it in. And what they did was they said, hey, we'll withdraw this if you preempt soda taxes. And that's exactly what they did. And I think, you know, here's an example of disinformation. I just want to cite to you the name of the organization under whose auspices people were signing this initiative petition. It was called Californians for Accountability and Transparency in Government Spending, sponsored by California businesses. So, I mean, you could see that petition and sign it and have no idea that what you were doing was, you know, playing part of a long game by Coca-Cola and its allies. It was a very sophisticated and, I should say, very effective campaign. The Santa Cruz soda tax is probably going to face a legal challenge based on this preemption.
So that's incredible that this is happening in California. I mean, especially because you hear in the media about liberal California, and it's so simplistic because you've got things like this. And a lot of people would be surprised to learn this if they don't know much about politics in California.
Yeah, and I mean, it's I think the liberal California part of it comes from Coca-Cola really had to do something because a number of municipalities were beginning to enact soda taxes, and so it was this was their strategy. Say, you know, instead of fighting brush fires everywhere, they were going to really try to nip it in the bud, and that's what they did.
And that's what they did under Jerry Brown. There's another interesting tidbit in your book about the Clinton Global Initiative in New York. Coca-Cola donated more than $5 million to the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative, and you have information about how in September 2014, the stage was grand and glittering at the Clinton Global Initiative, where the American Beverage Association made a strong claim it would reduce calories by 20% in 10 years. Former President Bill Clinton gave a speech about this, and sitting a few yards away, smiling, was Susan Neely of the American Beverage Association. Basically, he was reading their talking points.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this illustrates a couple of things that are interesting to me. One, they are, as we've discussed earlier, very, very well connected. And this is, you know, would be on both sides of the aisle for sure. You know, Coca-Cola has long been considered sort of the all-American beverage. And so it's not just Bill Clinton. They have deep ties everywhere. But yeah, there's also this idea, this deceptive claim that they're removing calories from the diet. And you know, I tried to make the case strongly in the book that you can't, with one hand, be marketing aggressively and promoting sugar-sweetened beverages as they do, as, you know, full sugar Coke gets the top shelf treatment, you know, at my corner store, at your corner store, everywhere across the country, everywhere across, you know, throughout the world. You cannot both aggressively do that and claim to be removing calories from the American diet. It just, you know, the two are completely at odds.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. A few years back, maybe 15 years, Coke made a huge blunder with introducing a new Coke without really making surveys of people if they wanted the new Coke versus the old Coke. And what happened was that they shoved all this new Coke in their cold drink refrigerators in stores around the country. And the consumers of Coke didn't like that. They boycotted the new Coke. They wanted the old Coke back. And they couldn't get the old Coke back until they drank up the new Coke to make room in the cold refrigerators. So I'm wondering, what was Coke's tactic? They're so clever and everything else. Why did they make such a huge blunder like this? And was this some other unknown factor that they were trying to get over on the public, you know?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think books have been written about this and movies, because it wasn't just a tactical blunder. It was a tactical blunder from basically the company that has won at capitalism. I mean, they know how to sell products. And yeah, I've never seen anything convincing to suggest that they had some nefarious purpose or anything else other than to think that they really were unveiling a better product that would more appeal to consumers. And it really backfired. I mean, and in the process, Pepsi gained market share on Coke. It was that was the Pepsi Wars. And it was really a strategic blunder on Coke's part.
Well, thank you so much for the question, Frank. We have a number of questions from people who are just asking about what's in the cans that are in the stores. Can you talk more about diet sodas and other drinks? Hannah writes, how does the new wave of prebiotic sodas fit into this narrative, like Poppy and Olipop? Are they just as harmful?
Yeah, this is interesting. That, you know, it's important, I would say, to read the to read the ingredients. There is this huge trend towards the prebiotic and you know, more so-called healthy sort of soda pops. It's really beyond my expertise to say, you know, what's good in each of these different products. I would say, you know, the sort of low-hanging fruit to cut out of your diet, and this is the message of my book, is the sugar. So really, really, whatever other products you're looking at, I would say, you know, sort of the coarse filter, the first thing to do is make sure that it's not really super sugar laden. Beyond that, I would be skeptical of any, you know, purported health benefits of a soda in a can, you know, whatever its ingredients are.
What would you say are alternatives? I tried so hard to get my dad off of these things because he also always had to have Crystal Light in his water. And so I would put in frozen blueberries. That didn't really work. But frozen pineapple actually has a really good flavor. So, I mean, I've tried so much with my dad's. You could put in orange and mint. That's really nice. What are some other alternatives that would help people try to get off these drinks?
Boy, that's such a tough question. And your father was not alone. I mean, there are many people who just don't drink tap water. They need to sort of doctor up their water in a way to make it acceptable to their palates. Again, you know, I'd reiterate the idea that something to, if you're used to consuming caffeine, add a little bit of caffeine. In terms of sweetness, pure fruit juices, I mean, fruit juices without additional sugar would be something to try that, you know, doesn't have the same health risks as sodas. So that would be something else you can try. But the other thing I would say is, you know, if you present water in a way, you know, it could be carbonated water or just flat water, but with ice and a nice presentation, maybe a slice of lime, a slice of lemon, some people might really find it an acceptable alternative to a soda.
Judy wants to know about carbonation. Did you run across any research on that?
I've only looked a little bit of research on that, and you know, it does not seem, as far as I understand it, to be a huge health risk. I wouldn't worry about like carbonated sodas, et cetera. If you're consuming a lot of anything, I would actually, you know, check with your dentist, check with your doctor if you really want medical advice. But again, you know, if it's carbonated water, you've eliminated the sugar, and so you're way better off there.
And again, you know, at the end of the day, this is all about making sure that we go in a different direction, because chronic diseases and cancer rates are just getting worse, and we're losing so many people because of diet. The science is clear. So final thoughts on this, Murray, and you know what you're really hoping to accomplish with this book, Sweet and Deadly?
Yeah, it's very basic. I mean, I argue in the book that the single item in the American diet that most contributes to chronic diseases is sugar-sweetened beverages. For a lot of your listeners, that may be a surprise because they may not be consuming any, but there are a lot of people who are still consuming quite a bit. And so my assertion or my hope would be that people just recognize the risks of sugar-sweetened beverages, eliminate those from their diet, or moderate, cut way back on their consumption. And that's could be, for many people, the first step in a long journey to better health.
Murray Carpenter has worked as a print and radio journalist in Maine for 25 years. He's the author of Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. His latest book is Sweet and Deadly, How Coca-Cola Spreads Disinformation and Makes Us Sick. Murray, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the May Day protests happening in all 50 states to build a united front against the Trump administration's extreme agenda. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.